Just because you're a... He groped for the word. Bruegel gave it to him.
A mutant. That's what they're... What we're called these days. Yes, I'm a creature of chaos. Look at me.
Bruegel pulsated, strange organs emerging from his torso.
It's a strange disease. I don't know if I'm dying of it or being reborn. I wish I were a writer like you, then maybe I could describe what it's like.
Does it hurt?
Some of the time. At others, it's quite pleasant, actually. I don't have to feel pain if I don't want to. Otherwise, I'd have given Crayley a nice little confession. Unfortunately, I can't protect myself through ignorance, you see. These tentacles in my belly can see what's uppermost in a man's mind. I know the details of the murders Crayley wants to beat and burn out of me, just as I know how you really feel about what I've become.
Detlef cringed inwardly and blurted an apology.
Don't be sorry. I'm disgusted at what I've become. I've always been disgusted at what I was. It's nothing new. I don't blame you at all. You're the only one who'd ever gave me a chance. I'm going to die soon, and I'd like you to know how grateful I've been for your friendship.
Varga, I won't let Crayley kill you.
No, you won't. I have the choice whether I live or die. I can stop my heart, tear it apart with the teeth I have inside my chest, and I intend to do it.
But Oswald is a fair man. He won't see you hanged for murders you didn't commit.
Bruegel's cilia writhed and changed colour.
No. But what about seeing me hanged for the murders I will commit? Even seeing me hanged for what I am. I'm changing.
That's obvious.
Not just in my body. My mind is changing too. I have impulses. The warp stone warps minds as well as bodies. I've been misremembering things, having strange ideas, strange desires. I'm altering severely. I could go to the wastes and lose myself in the hordes of chaos, join with all the other monsters. But I'd not be me anymore. I'm losing Varga Bruegel, and I don't think I want to leave behind what I'm about to become.
Bruegel gritted his teeth and strained against his chains. There was a great grinding inside his chest. His cilia deepened in colour and stuck out like fat sausages. Crayley and his men came rushing back.
"What's the beast doing?" asked the steward.
Detlef turned and hit him in the gut, hurting his knuckles more. Crayley bent double, swearing and coughing. Detlef wanted to hit the man again, but there was too much else going on for him to bother. Bruegel's torso swelled up, and he snapped his chains out of the wall. Smiling, he advanced on Crayley. The steward screamed as the monster came for him. Bruegel rattled his chains and, smiling, slapped his tormentor's face. He continued to expand, rents appearing in his skin. Eyes stood out like boils. He drew a great breath, inflating his lungs. Then he burst. Detlef stood back to avoid the splatter. The torturer fell over, putting a hand into the brazier of hot coals to steady himself. He screamed as his hand was roasted through. Bruegel fell apart with a great sighing. As he died, Varga Bruegel said,
"Good luck with the play."
4. When, 3 days later, the Imperial party arrived, things were as nearly back to normal as they ever could be. Detlef had supervised the burial of Varga Bruegel and informed Henrik Crayley that it would be in his own best interests to keep out of his way. Crayley put up notices announcing that Bruegel had been the murderer and muttered to his men that each day which passed without a fresh atrocity proved him right. If the dwarf had confederates, the steward did not spend too much of his time seeking them out. Privately, he expressed the opinion that the voices they had heard in the room where Manesh was murdered were those of the demons Bruegel was summoning with his unholy ritual. Murderer or not, Bruegel was much missed by the company. Detlef called a halt to rehearsals for an entire morning so that everyone could attend the assistant director's funeral. Detlef had him buried on the mountainside outside the fortress walls. Just as the trickster, a cleric after all, read the lesson, and Detlef gave a brief eulogy. The only conspicuously absent face was that of Lily Nissen, and she hadn't even been much in evidence at rehearsals recently. Bruegel had more friends than he knew. When Oswald came, Detlef vowed there would be a reckoning with Crayley, whom he considered his friend's murderer. The play was set in its final form now. Detlef went through a complete day of rehearsal without adding, deleting, or changing any lines, and an enormous cheer went up from the company. He took out his much-scribbled script and pondered a moment before pronouncing the text whole and finished. Then he delivered a 50-minute lecture on the finer points of the actual production, browbeating, upbraiding, cajoling and pampering those who deserved it, and enthusing his followers with the spirit of the piece. Watching from the audience, with a stand-in taking his role, Detlef thought the only dead spot was Lily, and there was really nothing to be done about that. At least she still looked incredible, teeth in or out, and her blankness could just barely be interpreted as undead detachment, even if that interpretation went against the grain of the play and the expectations of anyone who had met the real Genevieve Dieudonné. He could not speak for his own performance. That had been one of Bruegel's functions, to keep him alert as an actor, while he might be overly concerned with other details of the production. He hoped his friend would not be overly critical from the afterlife, and sought to curb the excesses Bruegel had continually pointed out to him. When runners appeared early in the morning to announce the imminent arrival of the Emperor and the electors, Detlef was confident enough to cancel the day's work and leave the company to their own devices. They would perform all the better for the rest and relaxation, and he knew they would appreciate the opportunity to gawk at rich and famous people. More than one young actress or musician vanished to their chambers to dig out their most fetching and or revealing costumes in the hope of attracting a wealthy patron among the Emperor's entourage. The Emperor Karl Franz rode into Castle Drachenfels at the head of his caravan. Oswald, Grand Prince Oswald now, a little behind him, and his son Luitpold doing his best to keep abreast. The Emperor waved, and the assembled cast cheered him. The rest of the caravan creaked and lumbered through the castle gates, and the courtyard became a chaos of ostlers and coachmen and servants. The dignified personages spilled out of their carriages and were led to the luxurious apartments that had been prepared for them in the wing of the fortress opposite the actors' quarters. Detlef heard Ilona Horvathy commenting enviously on Countess Emmanuel von Liebowitz's ridiculously bejewelled travelling clothes. He recognised the Elector of Middenland, who avoided his gaze, and hurried off, grey-faced, to find the privies. Some people don't travel well. Crayley turned out and got to Oswald first. He delivered a concise report, and Detlef saw the Elector's face grow serious. Oswald came over to Detlef, leaving Crayley to liaise with the new influx of guardsmen. "This has been a bad business."
"Yes, Highness, and made the worse for your servant."
Oswald was grave.
"So I gather. Varga Bruegel was innocent of any crime."
"Yet he was an altered."
"That is in itself not illegal?"
"For now, maybe. There are moves in the college. However, I assure you, this will not end here. Steps will be taken. You will be heard."
Young Luitpold ran up to Oswald and tugged at his coat excitedly. Then he became aware of Detlef and turned from a normal boy trussed up in a silly soldier suit to a miniature aristocrat with poise and bearing.
"Detlef Sirk, permit me to introduce Luitpold of the House of the Second Wilhelm."
The boy bowed, his hand fluttering before his face. Detlef returned the bow.
I am honoured, Highness.
His duty done, Luitpold returned his attention to Oswald.
Show me where you slew the monster, Oswald, and where your tutor was killed by Yuli the dwarf, and where the gargoyles came out of the walls.
Oswald laughed, but without much humour.
That can wait until Detlef's play. You'll find it all out then.
The future emperor dashed off, one silk stocking slipping to bunch at his ankle. Oswald looked more the proud parent than Karl Franz, Detlef thought. Then the Grand Prince turned serious again, as if suddenly aware of the place he had returned to.
We didn't come in through the courtyard, you know, he said. I only saw this afterwards, in the sunlight. We came in through the cliff gates, which lie beyond that arm of the fortress.
He pointed. By day, Drachenfels was just an ordinary mountain fastness. Only at night did the dread creep back.
That's where I saw Seer Jehan, my oldest friend, with his throat pulled out, bleeding his last.
We have all lost friends, Highness.
Oswald stared at Detlef, as if seeing him for the first time.
Forgive me. So, this place has claimed more victims. Sometimes I think we should have had it pulled down and scattered the stones, then seeded the site with salt and silver.
But then you wouldn't have been able to stage this pageant.
Maybe not.
Detlef could not help but notice that Oswald seemed more disturbed by the death of Seer Jehan 25 years ago than by those of Rudi Wegner and Menesh the Dwarf within the last week. The aristocrat had grown a tougher skin since his first visit to this place. The boy hero of Detlef's play was buried within the skilled politician, the dignified statesman. A sprightly man in early middle age approached them. He had doffed his ceremonial coat, and Detlef took a moment to recognise him in a plain black travelling suit.
Detlef, here is Luitpold's father.
Emperor Karl Franz of the House of the Second Wilhelm held out a hand. Detlef didn't know whether to shake it or kiss it, and opted to do both. To his surprise, he found himself immediately liking the man.
We've heard much of your work, Siak. I trust you'll not disappoint us tomorrow night.
I shall try not to, Majesty.
That's all we can ask for. Oswald, come, let's eat. I'm starving.
Karl Franz and Oswald left, arm in arm. So these, Detlef thought, are the giants, the true gods whose whims alter the courses of our lives, whose faults slaughter thousands, and whose virtues endure forever. Like the fortress of Drachenfels, they don't seem so much in the daylight. Genevieve appeared, hidden behind her strange dark glasses, and flew to Oswald. For a moment, Detlef wondered if what he was feeling was jealousy.
5.
While Oswald entertained Karl Franz and the electors in one wing of the fortress, and Detlef oversaw his dress rehearsal in the other, Anton Veit was preparing to leave Drachenfels. He took his weapons from their hidden places in his room and cleaned them. He wrapped a coil of rope around his skinny middle. He packed provisions enough for 3 days in the mountains, and he allowed himself a cigar, keeping the smoke down, controlling the spasms in his chest. He was not a stupid man. Erzbet dead, Rudi dead, Menesh dead. He could follow the trend. The vampire lady and the Grand Prince might be foolish enough to stay and invite their fates, but Veit was getting out now. 25 years ago, it had been the same. Conradin dead, Heinroth dead, Seer Jehan dead, Yuli the Dwarf dead, Stellan the Warlock dead. Others, whose names he couldn't even remember, dead, and Veit alone in the dark, waiting for death. Sometimes He wondered if he really had died in the passageways of this castle, and whether the remainder of his life was just a dream or a nightmare. As his black crab ate more, he felt himself being tugged back to those hours in the dark with the poison creeping into him. He would wake up at night, certain that the mattress beneath him was the stone floor of Castle Drachenfels. Could it be only minutes since Oswald and the others had left him to die here? Could he have imagined the whole course of his life in these few moments of unconsciousness? In the dark, the events of 25 years seemed a dream. How could he have ever believed such a hazy, marginal existence was real? These sick thoughts were a symptom of the dangers of this place. He should never have returned. There weren't enough gold crowns in the Empire to hire a man to commit suicide. He chose his time well. While Oswald was busy with his feast, and Detlef his performance. There would be guards about, but they weren't expecting anyone to attempt an escape. He should have no problem. And if he did come up against some itchy halberdier, he had his dart gun and his short sword. Actually, he had no reason to believe he couldn't just tell Oswald he was leaving and walk away from Drachenfels in the open. But he did not intend to chance the Grand Prince's whims. Oswald could as easily have him imprisoned as let him free, and there was no telling how important Veit really was to his pageant. In his old clothes, his hunting clothes, he left his room and crept down to the courtyard. It was well lit, and he could see too many men-at-arms. Crayley himself was supervising the watch, fanatically devoting himself to the security of the Imperial Party in an attempt to justify his earlier actions. The great doors were closed, so Veit would have to scale the walls to escape. The risk was too great. He would have to leave the castle the way they had come in all those years ago, through the gates at the clifftop. He had rope, and his grip was as good as ever. He could descend the mountains, get away into Britannia. Oswald would never reach for him there, and there were felons enough to keep his belly full. He could grow old with Bretonian wenches and Bretonian wine, and maybe burst his heart through excess before the crab killed him. Weeks ago, when they had arrived at the fortress, he had retraced the steps of their original expedition, searching for the spot where he had lain unconscious while Oswald was killing Drachenfels. He had not been able to find it. One stretch of corridor looked much like another. Now he paced the route again, reversing their path, pushing for the outside. He passed the great hall, where the play actors were recreating the death of Drachenfels, then worked his way slowly through the passage where Rudy had been caught in the wooden jaws of the trap. Beyond lay the place of his ordeal, the poison feast chamber, the gargoyle stones, the enchanted door that had killed Stellan, and the outer wall. His pains had receded in the last few days. Comfortable accommodations and real food will do that to you. He had been lulled by the luxuries and willfully ignored the dangers. But now fat old Rudy was gone, and one-armed Manesh, and poor mad Erzbet, buried without their eyes. Like him, they should have died here a quarter century ago, but had clung on beyond their time. Veit intended to cling just a little longer, with just a little more tenacity. He wandered for hours, longer than he should have, resting for a time in shadowed corners. It was late now. The dress rehearsal would be over, the feast quietening down. This part of the forest was deserted, shunned even, and no one stood between Veit and the safety of the night outside. Rudy had been found here, and the room where Manesh had been skinned was only a few turns of the corridor away. He was feeling the crab now, feeling it shift inside him. His heart hung like a stone in his chest, and his joints pained him. He was certain he was bleeding inside his clothes. He had to stifle coughing fits, lest his noise attract the guards. or even less welcome presences. Veit's feet dragged, as if he were wading through heavy sludge, and he remembered the gargoyle poison seeping through his veins, turning his flesh to the semblance of stone. Perhaps the sickness had just lain dormant in him all these years, awaiting his return to Drachenfels to strike again. Wet trickled down his face. He touched his hand to the graze and found it bleeding. The wound, made by the gargoyle's horn, had opened again. He stumbled, trying to force himself forwards, and fell headlong. His skull rang as it struck the flagstones. In his convulsive grip, his pistol discharged. He heard, rather than felt, the dart whiz along the floor under him and bury its tip in his thigh. Then the pain came. He rolled over and shuffled back until there was a wall behind him. The shaft was bent, but the head was embedded deep in his muscle. He made a fist around the dart and pulled, but it slipped through his fingers, and he was holding nothing. He couldn't get a strong enough hold on the shaft to get it out of his leg. Tired, he let sleep come. Then he was awake, alert, the ache in his leg cutting through the fuzziness of his senses. There were people in the passage with him, his old comrades. There was Erzbet, hanging back, long hair over her face, and Rudy, his loose skin flapping on his skeleton, and Manesh, leaking as he held in his guts with a raw hand. There were others. Seer Jehan, with his open neck. Heinroth, with his bones on the outside and skin on the inside. A cloud of hanging flesh particles in the rough shape of Stellan the Warlock, and the man in the mask. The man who was not quite Drachenfels, but who would do for the moment. The man who wanted Veit's eyes. He realised he had found the spot at last. 6. At the Emperor's feast, Genevieve felt she had been seated with the children, while Oswald and Karl Franz were at the head table, surrounded by the other electors. Genevieve was considered a suitable adornment to the secondary table, which was lorded over by Luitpold, the Emperor's son. The heir quizzed her excitedly about Drachenfels, but was disappointed to learn she had been unconscious during Oswald's hand-to-hand combat with the great enchanter. Genevieve was stuck next to Baroness Marlene's spotty daughter, Clotilde, whose entire world was boundaried by her wardrobe and her dance card. Clotilde, who was almost 18, insisted on treating her like a very young child in order to assert her own adulthood. With some amusement, Genevieve realised that the girl had no idea who, and particularly how old, she was. She ate sparingly and drank nothing. Sometimes she would glut herself simply for the taste, but she didn't need meat and bread for sustenance, and often too much ordinary fare would make her feel constipated and out of sorts. She could barely remember eating for the need of it. Matthias, advisor to the grand theogonist of the cult of Sigmar, nervously asked her if she danced, and she answered rather too emphatically in the negative. He didn't look up from his plate for the rest of the meal. She kept glancing at the head table and observing them. Oswald was quiet, sitting back and looking satisfied. The Countess Emmanuel was endeavouring to outshine everyone in the room, and Clotilde had already rhapsodised about her 20-foot train with its embroidered tracing of the imperial family tree and the intertwining line of von Liebewitz, her necklace of 300 matched sapphires, and her plunging cloth of gold bodice. Genevieve assumed that the Countess's tight clothes were padded. No real woman could fill out that much whalebone and silk. When the dress rehearsal was over, the feast was joined by a selected few invited from the company. Detlef entered, with Lily Nissen uncomfortably on his arm, and the actress was presented to the court. Some of the electors had the decency to blush, and others the indecency to drool in public. Genevieve was amused to see the look of utter hatred that passed between Lily and the Countess Emmanuel. Their gowns were a match for tastelessness and discomfort. Lily could not compete with the House of von Liebowitz with regards to expense, although she wore enough jewellery to drown a witch. But she could certainly expose more pink skin through cutaway panels and mesh leggings. The Countess and the actress kissed each other's cheeks without quite touching lips to skin, and complimented themselves on their youthful appearance, venom dripping from every syllable. "And I'm supposed to be the bloodsucker," Genevieve thought. "You know," Genevieve said to Clotilde, who was always forgetting that she was only almost 18, "I must be the only woman in this room who never has to lie about my age." The girl giggled nervously. Genevieve realised she was showing her teeth and closed her lips demurely.
"I know how old you are," said Luitpold. "It's in the Ballad of Oswald and Genevieve. You're 638.
Clotilde choked on her watered wine, quite spoiling her dress. "That was 25 years ago, Highness," Genevieve said.
"Ah, then you must be..."
Luitpold stuck his tongue into his cheek and worked it out in his head.
663.
"That's correct, Highness." She raised her glass in salute, but not to her lips. The meal was over and the company stood up. Clotilde got as far away as possible, and Genevieve felt a little sorry for the girl. She reminded her of her sister, Cyrielle. Luitpold was attentive now.
"Let's go and see Daddy. He can't stand Middenheim and Talbheim. He'll want to be rescued."
The future emperor escorted her to the knot of highly placed toadies gathered around Karl Franz. Lily was doing her best to attract the attention of a tough-looking young man Genevieve believed to be the Elector of Sudenland, and not doing terribly well. Countess Emmanuel was fluttering her eyelashes at Detlef. In the Southlands, Genevieve had seen great black cats being civil to each other over the carcasses of deer, and then tearing red flaps from their rivals' glossy hides. Now she could almost see the claws sliding from their sheaths as the Countess and Lily purred around each other. Genevieve did feel like a child in this company. Their interrelationships were so complicated, and the things she could see on the surface of their minds ran so violently counter to the things they said. Still, it was no worse than the court of the first family of Paravon had been. And she felt better about Karl Franz than almost any other man of power she had ever met. Huberman's musicians were discreetly admitted, and there was dancing. This was not the joyous abandon there had been at the party for poor Rudy, but a courtly ritual that had changed only slightly since it was taught to her as a girl of Luitpold's age. It had nothing to do with enjoyment, and everything to do with ceremony and the reassertion of each dancer's place in the rigid order of the world. In the absence of his wife, Karl Franz led the dance with the Countess Emmanuel, looking considerably happier than she as he peered into her cleavage. Oswald pleaded exhaustion after the journey and sat at his table. Lily forced herself on Sudenland, who trampled her feet deliberately and obstinately stayed out of step. Detlef petitioned Genevieve, but she had promised the first pavane to another. Luitpold was tall for his age, and so they danced well together, the youngest and the oldest in the room. She touched his mind and sensed his excitement at the occasion. He was looking forward to the play and to more hunting with his uncle Oswald. In the distance of his life was the empire and the crown, but he was ignoring them for the moment. She found herself clinging to this ordinary boy in fine clothes, feeling in him a hope for a future she would inevitably have to live to see. Detlef prized her away from the heir to the empire, and she realised he was insistent partly because he wished to be with her, and partly because he suspected her intentions with regards to Luitpold. Young blood could be so enticing. They danced together for the rest of the evening. At some point, Oswald slipped away. Genevieve felt his absence less keenly than she felt Detlef's presence, and they continued in each other's arms. Inevitably, the feast had left her aroused but unsatisfied. Now she was thirsty, and here was Detlef, hot blood coursing through his veins. That night, in Genevieve's chamber, Detlef gave of himself to her. She undid his jerkin and pulled it open, then loosened the drawstrings of his shirt. His hands were in her hair and his kisses upon her brow. Delicately, with her sharp teeth, she opened a fold in Detlef's neck, just grazing the major artery, and savoured on her tongue the blood of genius. In his blood was everything he was. As she lapped the welling red, she learned of his past, his future, his secrets, his fears, his ambitions. Then she fastened upon him like a leech as he responded to her caresses and gulped greedily, smearing her mouth. The blood was warm and salty in the back of her throat as she took it down. She forgot Oswald von Königswald and clung to Detlef Sierck. 7. Constant Drachenfels stared at his masked face in the mirror, peering into his own malevolent eyes, relishing the powers he felt rising within him. He flexed his hands, feeling the strength soaked into the bones with seas of blood. He passed his pointed tongue over long teeth. Inside his armour, his body was drenched with sweat from his recent exertions. He was so close to the attainment of his purpose. He needed water to replenish his fluids. A jug and a goblet stood by the mirror. He pushed his mask off his face. And Laszlo Lohenstein poured himself a drink.
"Great, Laz! You were terrific!" That fool Jessner thumped him on the back. "You chilled my blood!"
"Thank you."
Soon, Lohenstein would have to be polite no more, would bow to no man, neither emperor nor director. He looked at the mask in his hand and saw his real face. When Jessner had gone, he worked away at the makeup around his eyes, peeling it off. He renewed the subtle paints he had applied over the discoloration of his face. Tomorrow, he would have no need of deceptions and could show himself as he really was. The changes were mainly under the skin, but soon the new bones would poke through. Soon he would truly fill the armour of the great enchanter. Soon. Long after everyone had left the dressing rooms, Lohenstein departed. He made his way to the part of the fortress where his patron awaited him. There was more to be carved, and Lohenstein was growing ever more skilled at the task. The man in the mask stood over a corpse, arms casually folded, unattended by any of his ghosts.
"The bones," said his patron. "This time we need the bones."
Lohenstein's knives worked quickly. He filleted Anton Veit expertly, carving away the flesh, and soon had the skeleton unclothed. In the red meat there were stringy lumps of a black stuff he had never seen before, but it parted under the knife like ordinary meat.
"Don't forget the eyes."
Two scoops and the job was done. Lohenstein imagined his patron smiling behind his mask.
"A fine job, Lohenstein. We have it all, nearly. The heart, the flesh, the skin, the vitals, the bones. From the vampire lady, we shall need the blood."
"And from the Grand Prince? From the murderer of the enchanter?"
The man in the mask paused. "From him, Lohenstein. From him, we shall take everything."
Act 5. 1. An hour to curtain up. There was no feeling in the world like it. Each sensation was amplified a thousandfold. The itches of his love bites, covered now by the high collar of his Prince Oswald costume, excited him. The air in the dressing rooms was electrically charged. He had sat in his chair, applying his makeup, calming himself, thinking himself into the role. 25 years ago, Prince Oswald had won his greatest victory in the Great Hall of Castle Drachenfels. Tonight, the battle would be re-fought, but the triumph would be Detlef Sieg's. He was the young Oswald, working up his courage before daring to challenge the great enchanter. He felt his freshly shaved chin and played with his moustaches. A bottle of wine stood unopened on the table. Good luck notes were sorted in order of importance. There was even a modest message of well-wishing from the Elector of Middenland, who must be praying for Detlef to trip over his sword on his first entrance and split his tights in the love scenes. He glanced over his shoulder at a hunched shape he'd glimpsed in the mirror. A hunched shape where there should be none. It was a cloak, carelessly flung. He picked it up, folded it, and put it away. Varga Bruegel's small chair was empty.
"For you, my friend," Detlef vowed. "Not for the Emperor, not for Oswald, for you."
Detlef tried to feel that Bruegel was present. But it was useless. There was nothing. He felt nervous, but good. He knew the 6-hour performance was going to be an enormous drain on his resources. He had worried that Genevieve had sapped his energies too much. On the contrary, since her kisses, he had felt doubly alive, as if her strength were shared with him. He felt able to bear the weight of his role. He had the reserves to perform lengthy soliloquies, to take part in strenuous and spectacular fight scenes, to clash with the powerful stage presence of Laszlo Lohenstein. He could even overcome his distaste and make love to Lily Nissen. He left his room and went among his cast. Ilona Horvathy was being sick in a bucket.
"It's all right," she choked between heaves. "I'm always like this. It's a good sign. Honest."
Reinhard Jessner was taking a few practice swings with his sword.
"Careful," said Detlef. "Don't bend it."
The actor bowed as best he could in his padded jacket with its false stomach. He saluted his director.
"You are right, my prince. Know well that I, Rudi Wegner, King of the Bandits, will serve you faithfully, to the death."
Since Rudi's death, Jessner had been throwing himself into his role almost as much as Lohenstein, as if trying to bring the old man back to life through the power of impersonation. Giswoldo was pumping pig's blood into the bladder in his armpit, whistling as he did so, in defiance of an old superstition. He gave Detlef the thumbs up.
"No problem, chief."
"Where's Lily?" Detlef asked Justus.
"No one's seen her all day. She should be in her dressing room."
"Any idea whether the Elector of Sudenland came through?"
The trickster priest laughed.
"Evidently not, Detlef."
"Good. Maybe the frustration will build up in her. We might see a performance from the monster yet."
Justus, a gargoyle below his neck, lashed his tail.
"We've come a long way since Munzen Keep, eh?"
"That we have. Good luck."
"Break a leg?"
A piercing scream rang out. Detlef looked at Justus, who looked back in astonishment. There was another scream. It came from Lily's dressing room.
"Ulrich in heaven! What plagues us now?"
Lily's dresser exploded from the room, blood on her hands, screeching insanely.
"Oh, gods, she's killed the bitch."
Justus held the bowed and bent woman, calming her. Detlef pushed into the dressing room. Lily stood in the middle of the room, in her Genevieve dress, a stripe of blood running from her face down her bosom to the floor. She had made fists in the air and was screaming at the top of her considerable voice. An admirer had sent her a present. Detlef tried to get through to the hysterical actress. When that failed, he took great delight in slapping her face. She lashed out at him, going for the throat, and he had to get a wrestler's hold on her.
"I knew I should never have come here. If it weren't for Oswald, I'd never have worked with you again. You, lowest of the loathsome, you vermin-tongued piece of swine shit, you leech spawn!"
She collapsed, sobbing on a divan, and refused to be comforted. Detlef turned to the mess on the floor and immediately understood what had happened. It had been like a jack-in-the-box. Once opened, it had flung its contents up at Lily Nissen, and its contents were only too recognisable. There was a face in there, the eyeless face of Anton Veit.
I won't do it! I shan't do it! You can't make me! I'm leaving this accursed place this hour, this instant!
Lily shouted at her dresser, and the poor woman freed herself from Justus. She began packing the actress's things into an open trunk.
Lily, the show starts in an hour. You can't leave.
Just watch me, worm dung. I'm not staying here to be murdered and abused.
But Lily...
Word was spreading through the company of this latest calamity. There were crowds at Lily's dressing room door, peering in at the star in disarray and the gory garbage strewn across everything. Lowenstein appeared, his costume complete but for the mask, and observed dispassionately. Detlef looked to the other actor, knowing that his career would be ruined too if Lily betrayed them all. Lily sat, arms crossed, watching her dresser pack, barking orders at the crying woman. She scraped at the blood on her face and wiped away her half-applied makeup. She pulled out her fangs one by one and threw them at the floor.
All of you! She snapped. Out! I'm changing! I'm leaving!
Her giant slave prodded Detlef in the chest, and he got the impression he ought to get out of the room. In the narrow passage between the dressing rooms and the stage, he slumped against the wall. It was all going to be ruined, and Lily Nissen was deserting him again. He'd never be able to get backing for another production. He would be lucky to get a job carrying spears in a provincial production of some tenth-rate tragedy. His friends would desert him faster than oarsmen escaping from a sinking galleass. It would take all he had to stay out of Munzen Keep. He saw the known world falling apart around him and wondered if he might not do best just to sign up with some forlorn hope voyage of discovery to the northern wastes and have done with it.
Somebody left it for her, Justus told him. It was wrapped like a gift, a gown or something, and there was a coat of arms on the note.
Great. Someone wants this play taken off before curtain up.
Here.
The cleric gave him a bent and bloodied piece of stiff paper. There was an unreadable scrawl of a message and the smudged impression of a seal. Detlef recognised it. A stylized face mask.
Drachenfels.
The great enchanter must still have supporters out there, desperate to protect their master's reputation by putting a stop to this recreation of his downfall. Lowenstein stood aside calmly, awaiting orders from his director. Justus, Jessner, Ilona Horvathi, Geswaldo and the others were all quiet, intent upon him. He could stop it here and get out of it with the minimum of dignity. Or he could proceed with the play, simply ignoring the absence of the leading lady. Or... Detlef tore the paper up and swore to Sigmar, to Verena, to all the gods, to the Emperor, to the Grand Prince, to Varga Bruegel, and to himself that Drachenfels would go on, bitch Lily or no. The crowds parted and someone came through, her lovely face shining.
Genevieve, he said, just the person I wanted to see.
2. Emperor Karl Franz I sat in his box at the rear of the great hall, raised above his subjects, with Luitpold to one side and Oswald at the other. An attendant held out a tray of sweetmeats, which Luitpold had been gluttonously helping himself to. The red curtain hung in front of the raised stage, sporting tragic and comic masks picked out in gold. He glanced over his programme, gathering from the order of the names listed when each player would make his entrance. Drachenfels boasted a prologue, 5 acts, and an envoy, with 6 intervals, including one for a buffet supper. It should run about 6 hours. Karl Franz shifted in his comfortable seat, and wondered whether Luitpold could sit still for the whole thing. It would be a great tribute to Detlef Sierck if the boy could manage it. Of course, Luitpold was eager to learn what his uncle Oswald had done as a youth. Oswald himself sat cool and quiet, refusing to be drawn on what he knew of the drama. "The story is ordinary," he had said. "It's the presentation which counts." The curtain's rise was a good 10 minutes late by Carl Franz's antique timepiece. He had expected no less. In his empire, nothing ever started on time. Countess Emmanuel was wearing another astonishing creation this evening. It took the off-the-shoulder concept to such an extent that it might almost be classed as off the entire body. The grand theogonist was already asleep, but he had his adviser Matthias beside him to prod him if he snored too loudly. As usual, Baron Johann von Mecklenburg looked uncomfortable with a roof over him, but he was wearing his court clothes better as time passed. Talleyrand and Middenheim were conferring together. Plotting, probably. The halfling was drunk. Middenland had heard there would be dancing girls wearing very little, and was salivating in his corner, his programme quivering over his padded codpiece. Princes, counts, electors, high priests, barons, burgomeisters, dukes, and an emperor. This must be the most distinguished audience in history. Detlef Sierck should be proud of it. A strange thought came to Karl Franz. If anything were to happen tonight, if a keg of lighted gunpowder were hurled into the audience, for instance, then a country would fall. The Empress could never reign in his stead, and all the other logical successors were here. Like every man to occupy his position since the time of Sigmar 2.5 millennia ago, Karl Franz was conscious of the precariousness of his seat. Without him, without these men, the empire would be a writhing collection of warring cities and provinces within 3 months. It would be like Tylea, but stretching the continent from Britonia to Kislev.
"When's it going to start, Father?"
"Soon. Even emperors must wait upon art," Luitpold.
"Well, when I'm emperor, I won't."
Karl Franz was amused.
"You have to grow up, prove yourself, and be elected first."
"Oh, that."
The house lights dimmed, and the chatter died down. A spot struck the curtains, and they split, allowing a man in knee breeches and a wig to emerge. There was a smattering of applause.
"Felix Huberman," said Oswald, "the conductor."
The musicians in their pit raised their instruments. Huberman bowed, but didn't produce his baton.
"Your Majesties, my lord, ladies and gentlemen," he said in a high, mellifluous voice, "I have an announcement to make."
There was a ripple of murmuring. Huberman waited for it to die down before continuing.
"Owing to a sudden indisposition, the role of Genevieve Dieudonné will not be taken at this performance by Miss Lily Nissen."
There were audible moans of disappointment from several electors who ought to have known better. Middenland spluttered with indignation. Baron Johann and Countess Emmanuel, for different reasons, sighed with relief. Karl Franz looked at Oswald, who shrugged blankly.
"Instead, the role of Genevieve Dieudonné will be taken by Miss Genevieve Dieudonné."
There was general amazement. Even Oswald was taken aback.
"Your Majesty, my lords, ladies and gentlemen, thank you."
Huberman raised his baton, and the orchestra struck up the Drachenfels overture. The first 3 basso chords, keyed to the syllables of the great enchanter's name, chilled Karl Franz's spine. The strings came in, and the curtains parted on a rocky promontory in the grey mountains. The chorus came forward and began.
"Listen, my masters, and listen well. For I have a tale of horrors to tell, of heroes and demons and blood and death, and the vilest monster e'er to draw breath."
3. After the apparition in the palace scene, Lohenstein didn't have much to do until the 5th and last act. He had to show his masked face a few times, giving orders to the forces of evil, and he had personally to rip apart Heinroth the Vengeful in Act 3, but it was Detlef's show, until the final battle, when he would return to the stage to end it all. He had the dressing room to himself. Everyone else was watching the play from the wings, which was a good thing, considering what he had to do. The material was laid out for him, the bones, the skin, the heart, and so on. A cheer went up from the stage as Detlef as Oswald skewered an orc. He heard the dialogue continuing and the clumping of boots as Detlef strode around the stage, demonstrating his swagger. Lohenstein gathered the vampire wasn't doing badly. This was the moment his patron had been schooling him for. He read the words from the paper he had been given, not recognising the syllables, but understanding the meaning. Lohenstein no longer had the dressing room to himself. Blue fire burned around the material as it filled out with the invisible force. Veit's skeleton, clothed in Rudy's fat and Manesh's skin, sat up. Erzbet's heart began to beat, hungry for Genevieve's blood. The thing had the outline of a man, but was not the man himself. The eyes were in a box on Lohenstein's dressing table. There were seven of them. One of Rudy's had been squashed beyond use in the struggle. His patron had told him it wouldn't matter. He opened the box and saw the eyes expressionless and veined in their clear jelly, like a clump of outsized frog spawn. Lohenstein plucked a blue eye, one of Veit's, from the sticky mass, and swallowed it whole. A section of his forehead peeled away. He took a handful of eyes and, fighting disgust, stuffed them into his mouth. He got them down. The composite creature watched from its eye sockets. Pain racked through Lohenstein's body as the changes came upon him fully. Only three more to go. He popped one into his mouth and gulped it back. It stuck halfway, and he had to swallow another to keep it down. Spines sprouted from his knees, and the knobbles of his vertebrae broke the skin. His bones were expanding. He was in agony. There was one eye left, a brown one, Erzbet's. As he ate it, the creature embraced him, taking him into its open chest, folding its ribs about him. The dying and dead sights of Erzbet, Rudy, Manesh and Veit played back to him. Himself, masked, bent over a corpse in the Temple of Mor. Himself, masked, at a table surrounded by ghosts. Himself, masked, wielding a red knife in a circle of candlelight. Himself, masked, crouched in a passageway, pulling bones free from a human ruin. Fire burned throughout his body, and he completed the ritual, shrieking. It was a wonder no one heard him, but there were wonders enough to go around. Veit's bones sank into him like logs thrown into a swamp. Rudy's fat plumped out his gaunt frame. Manesh's skin settled on his own, mottling it, and Erzbet's heart beat next to his own, like a polyp nestling its mother. He was Laszlo Lohenstein no longer. Reaching for his mask, he was Constant Drachenfels, and he was looking forward eagerly to the fifth act. 4. On the stage, she felt as if she were floating. Unsupported, she tried to find her way through the play without making a fool of herself. Some of the time she could remember the lines Detlef had written for her. Some of the time she remembered what she had actually said. Most of the other actors were good enough to work round her. The scenes with Detlef played marvellously because she still had the flush of his blood in her. She could read the lines of his play from the surface of his mind, and she could see where she was straying from the text. Her first scene found her behind the bar in the crescent moon, surrounded by crowds, waiting for Oswald to walk into her life. The crowds were extras, hubbubbing softly without words, and from her position she could see Detlef waiting in the wings, his Oswald helmet under his arm, and the faces of the audience out in the darkness. Unlike the living actors, she could see clearly beyond the footlights. She saw the Emperor, attentive, and the real Oswald a little behind him, watching with approval. And yet, she was also seeing the real tavern, smelling again its distinctive smell of people and drink and blood. Individual extras who would rush off and make themselves over as courtiers, bandits, villagers, monsters, orcs, gargoyles, or forest peasants for later scenes, reminded her of the individual patrons she had known then. Through his play, Detlef was bringing it all back. One of the things about longevity, Genevieve didn't like to think of it as immortality, too many vampires she had known were dead, was that you got to try everything. In nearly 7 centuries now, she had been a child of court, a whore, a queen, a soldier, a musician, a physician, a priestess, an agitator, a gambler, a landowner, a penniless derelict, a herbalist, an outlaw, a bodyguard, a pit fighter, a student, a smuggler, a trapper, an alchemist, and a slave. She had loved, hated, killed, but never had children. The dark kiss came too early. Saved lives, travelled, studied, upheld the law, broken the law, prospered, been ruined, sinned, been virtuous, tortured, shown mercy, ruled, been subjugated, known true happiness, and suffered. But she had never yet acted upon the stage, still less taken her own part in a recreation of her own adventures. The story progressed, as Detlef as Oswald gathered together his band of adventurers and set out on the road to Castle Drachenfels. Again, as on her recent journey along the same road, Genevieve found herself remembering too much. The faces of her dead companions were superimposed on the faces of the actors representing them, and she could never forget the images of their deaths. As Reinhard Jessner blustered and slapped his padded thigh, she saw Rudi Wegener's skin draped over his bones. As the youth she had bled conferred with Detlef, she remembered Conradin's chewed bones in the ogre's lair, and as the actor playing Veit sneered through clouds of cigar smoke, she saw the bounty hunter's face on Lily Nissen's dressing room floor. Lily would be halfway down the mountain now, speeding back to Altdorf and civilization, and the creature who frightened her, who murdered Veit and the others, would be close by, perhaps coming after her next, or Oswald. The play advanced act by act, and the heroes braved peril after peril. Detlef had imagined a jauntiness in their progress Genevieve couldn't remember. There were heroic speeches and a passionate love scene. All Genevieve could recollect of the first trip were long days, painful for her under the sun, on a horse, and desperate, fearful nights around a fire. When Heinroth was found turned inside out, the script had her make a vow over his corpse to continue the quest. In fact, she had considered backing out and going home. She played it down the middle, her old fears suddenly reborn. And Detlef improvised a response finer than anything he'd written for the scene. The blanket of pig entrails representing Heinroth looked more real, more shocking to her than the actual corpse had done. Ilona Horvathi had some difficulty working around the changes in the script and was nervous in her scenes with Genevieve. But Erzbert had always been afraid of her, and the actress's uncertainty worked for the character. Watching Ilona's athletic dances, she was more skilled than Erzbert had been. Genevieve worried she would take some knocks in the fight scene in the last act, and that the drama would come to a premature conclusion. In the love scene,